Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson, and this evening we'll be talking about the proposed Minnesota Compassionate Care Act of 2015. This Friday at 6 p.m., UMD's Center for Ethics and Public Policy will hold a panel discussion on the act, which would make lethal medication available to terminally ill patients from their doctors in order to end their own lives. The legislation is proposed by Senator Chris Eaton along the lines of the law in Oregon that allowed Brittany Maynard the right to take her own life earlier this spring. We'll talk with two of the panelists from the upcoming discussion. First, Kirk Allison, the director of the Program in Human Rights and Health at the University of Minnesota.
The program is interested broadly in vulnerable populations, and this could run, you know, prenatally to postmortem. Meaning, for example, I also have an association with the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies, and of course, in those contexts, you're concerned about individuals also receiving justice after events that are quite horrific. The program has been in the School of Public Health since 2006, and out of it we do research, we do teaching, we do public events. I teach courses on health and human rights, one on global health, relief development, and religious and non-religious NGOs. A recent course was on an international humanitarian crisis simulation. I've had a course also that deals with the history of lethality in medicine and public health and research ethics and those sorts of things. It's interesting to hear the title of the act. The act is called the Compassionate Care Act. And, you know, who could be against compassionate care? But it also seems to imply that care up to this date, currently administered, including palliative care and other possibilities, doesn't meet the bar of providing fully compassionate care. In other states, of course, it's been called death with dignity and other terms. My own view and my own position is that I'm against this act, and I think it has a number of elements that put patients at risk. And I think it also transforms the nature of medicine. I think one also should take a look at some of the developments as they developed other places, both in the United States and in Europe, for example, in the Netherlands, to see where this act might go. There was a recent article by Art Kaplan, whom some of you will know from CNN and from his time in Minnesota, concerning developments in the Netherlands and Belgium, in which he says that this brings a new concern and good reason to think about the direction that things may be heading. So in general, I'm against it for a variety of reasons, and they concern the nature of the transformation of medicine. They concern the issues of vulnerable patients, and also the issues of the effects of such a law and such a direction on people who aren't primarily thought about in this context. So, for example, the question is, if one normalizes a kind of suicide, even though in the law the word suicide is outlawed, one cannot use this in the law, if one normalizes a certain kind of taking one's life or this being institutionalized, are there external effects in other areas, including effects on, quote, you know, conventional suicide, and other individuals thinking about taking their life, saying, well, if you can do it in this context, should I not be able to do it in my context? There's additional elements that I think bring concern, and this is common to the laws in Washington State and in Oregon, and that has to do with the kind of documentation and the fact that in those states and also in the Minnesota bill, it requires that the physician falsify the death certificate. And that's a major problem for me as a public health person, a public health researcher, as a public health researcher in person, and somebody who actually did a research rotation and was a visiting preceptor in the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office. Death certificates should provide accurate information about the efficient cause of death. One can always put down underlying contributors, but in fact, in this case, it's clear that a person, even if they have a terminal condition, they're not dying of that terminal condition when they take a lethal prescription, when they ingest something and it has a lethal effect, and it's prescribed in a dosage that's intended to kill the patient. Now, maybe the person really wants that as an outcome, but I just think in terms of transparency and for the public health record, it's very, very important that we be accurate. It also means that these death certificates aren't traceable in terms of patterns in the future. And if there's a pattern of, let's say, one provider having an unusually large percentage of patients who go this route, which seems to be really out of the ordinary in terms of normal trends, even in states where this is legal, there would be no way to reconstruct this. So I think there's a number of levels of concern that that I have and that people should really take stock of.
The case of the young woman in Oregon who had an aggressive brain tumor, and she knew that she was going to die an agonizing death, and she knew that she was going to lose her ability to think and to function and to be the person that her parents knew, that her husband knew. It's hard not to look at her case and say, absolutely, she should have the right to die with her senses intact, the way she wanted to, not in pain. How do you address the individual cases, perhaps, that people point to and say, yeah, but...
Brittany Maynard was a person that definitely had a lot of courage and conviction about this. In fact, she moved her family from California to Oregon for this. I think one of the things one has to think about is that this is an issue that's not just about autonomy. It's not just about the individual. And that's the way it's usually framed. There's also external effects of policies. And if one's thinking in terms of public health, one is concerned about those external effects. Now, one could understand somewhat sympathetically, of course, that I wouldn't want to suffer certain kinds of impairments, et cetera, et cetera. But we do have very good palliative care. We do have, in the end of life, in sort of extreme cases, even what's called a palliative sedation. And certainly, in this kind of a situation, there's going to be cases that are very difficult, and I don't want to minimize the difficulty and really the emotional impact of those cases. She's a person that's obviously is also a case that even though in Oregon the death certificate would be falsified, she was fine to have a public face on this and so forth. Now, one thing that's interesting about her case is that there have been documented cases in which other people have cited her videos. For example, there's a young man in British Columbia who came in who was suicidal, and he came into his physician, or his mother actually brought him in to his physician, and he said, well, I am suicidal, and of course a good question to ask anybody. This is just sort of generally, even if you're a layperson, if you have somebody who seems to be talking in this direction, a good question to ask, do you have a plan? And he said, yes, I have a plan. I saw Brittany Maynard's video, and because of that, I identified with her, and I think if she should be able to do that in her situation, I should be able to in my situation. And after that, I started looking on the Internet to see if I could somehow purchase on the Internet the kinds of drugs that she had. Now, he was an individual who was not terminally ill in any sense at all. And he was inspired by this example to actually pursue this. And very interestingly, in the state of Oregon, there, if you look at the statistics on suicide, that's not in the medical context, before 2000, they had a decreasing rate, and the bill was introduced and passed, and the law went into effect toward the end of 1999. And after that, they've had an increase of suicide in Oregon that has brought it to be the second highest in the nation and has increased its rate over 46%. So I think there's reasons for both compassion and compassion is a very interesting word, because in Latin, compassion means to suffer alongside somebody. It means to accompany them. It does not mean that one should leave them in isolation. One should leave them without care. But it means being alongside the person. And I think that's an area of medicine, including in palliative care, where the potentialities of palliative care are not so well understood, even within the medical community, let alone the patient community.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about the proposed Minnesota Compassionate Care Act of 2015, and our guest for the first part of the program is Kirk Allison, the director of the Program in Human Rights and Health at the University of Minnesota. Greg O'Brien has been in the news lately. He's a man who's been living with Alzheimer's disease and stage 3 prostate cancer for 6 years. Greg decided not to treat the cancer in the hopes that it would end his life before the Alzheimer's disease robs him of his identity. I read to Kirk a quote from O'Brien's doctor. The doctor himself is a cancer patient also, in which he told O'Brien that his family would be okay. "Nobody is indispensable," he said. "Nobody. And if you or I were to immediately vanish from the earth, our families would do fine. They have family support. They have friend support. They're in a nice community. It's a terrible sense of loss that they'll have, but they will do fine. And if they're honest with themselves, they'd realize that they're going to do fine."
Well, I think in some ways that's a little too dismissive. I mean, it is true that none of us are, quote, indispensable. You know, if I got run over, somebody else could take my job. And if you got run over, somebody else would be on the radio in a few weeks, right? So in that way, that's true. But I do think that there is a tendency of dismissing the importance of people who have significant and even ongoing progressive disability and impairment. And I think of a friend of mine, for example, who had ALS, and within 6 months he went from walking every week, he lost an activity of daily living, basically, until he was in a wheelchair, and he motorized, and he died. It was very, very fast. It was within 6 weeks, and as the time went on, actually, the positive effects that he had on other people continued and increased, and were very tangible and very. Very clear. It's very striking that the vast majority of people in the disability movement are against physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia and these sorts of things, because they understand how lives can be devalued. And even, for example, I have a friend here at the university who has somebody in their family who has had severe impairments. I believe they have severe cerebral palsy and these sorts of things. And when they've been brought to the emergency room for various conditions, it has at times been a fight to have them treated in an aggressive manner. I know another woman, for example, who has a child that has mental retardation, and he also has cerebral palsy. And when she took him to the dentist, they asked him to get like wisdom teeth out so you would have some anesthesia. That would be a little more general in this particular case. They asked him, "Do you want to have a DNR, a do not resuscitate order, signed for him?" And she said, "Why would you ask me that question?" And they said, "Well, it's just normal." She said, "Well, when my other children had wisdom teeth out and had similar anesthesia, nobody asked that question. They only asked the question about my disabled son." And so I think that's a concern. Now, for the person that is saying, "Well, I don't want to lose my memory and my identity and so forth," you know, Alzheimer's is an extremely tragic situation. And of course, the way it works is that people tend to lose the most recent memories and things, the short term first, and things that are deeper last longer. So things like things they've been involved in. Some of it could be ritual sorts of things, such as community actions or church or things like that. Or music is very deep, actually, with people with Alzheimer's. I know a woman who herself, it's very interesting, she herself has a couple of conditions that are progressive, and including learning, losing language and this sort of thing. But she works with a dance group that goes to care centers that have people with Alzheimer's in that. And she talked about when she, and this woman is almost 80, I think, and she said when they went to this group, all the people were sitting around and weren't doing very much. But when they turned music on that was at the time of their experience and growing up, and she said in this case it was like jitterbug music, she said they turned it on, several of the people, they got up and began to dance, they began to engage, they began to do things. So there were things that they were able to connect with still if a person had the ability and the skill and sort of the knowledge of certain ways that one can interact. Now, it doesn't mean that in every case that this would be the outcome. But I think that there's a tendency of devaluing people that have severe impairments, and that's a way that a reason why individuals with disabilities in the disability community would be concerned about this. Now, there are some other people, for example, Stephen Hawking supports the idea, but he's not typical in this regard. Concerning the disability community. Some of the most articulate individuals are with an organization called Not Dead Yet, and they know by experience what has happened. And again, this doesn't mean that there's not individuals that have severe disabilities that don't want this, but one also needs to think about the external effects of this in the broader community from the standpoint of a public health perspective.
Dr. David Mayo is a professor emeritus of philosophy at UMD, and he's a board member of the Death with Dignity National Council. Dr. Mayo, thanks so much for joining us. Good to talk with you again after all these years.
My pleasure.
Talk about where you're coming from on this issue.
Well, where I'm coming from is that there are two obvious arguments in favor of giving people who are clearly right at the end of their lives, most of whom are in hospice and who see no point in drawing this out, the right to have access to medications which they may or may not take, the obvious utilitarian argument that we don't like to see animals suffer, why do we insist upon dying people hanging on until they die, quote, natural deaths. But I think the more important argument has to do with the notion of control. As the record shows in Oregon, very few people actually take this medication. It's somewhere between 20 and 40 per year over the 20 years that this has been the law in Oregon. But everybody in Oregon knows that they have that option. People know that they can be in control. I'd point out that being in control of things is very, very important, and life confronts us with many, many things that we don't like. A bad term paper due, a car that keeps breaking down, a lousy marriage. Most bad things that we don't like, we can simply opt out of. If the term paper looms too large, you can quit the course. If the marriage is too terrible, you can get out of it. Illness is different. When you become ill, there's no way to sort of opt out of that. And when you find out you're dying, that is sort of the ultimate loss of control. And what this does is it restores control. I would throw a quick quote at you from a Dr. Eric Cassell out of a book entitled The Healer's Art. He writes, "If I had to pick some aspect of illness that is most destructive to the sick, I would choose the loss of control. Maintaining control over oneself is so vital to all of us that one might see all the other phenomena of illness as doing harm, not only in their own right, but doubly so as they reinforce the sick person's perception that he's no longer in control. Thus, the doctor's job is to return control to his patient." So what this does is says to people who are dying, you are in charge of how you're dying. The last major event of your life is not something that you just suffer, but that you are in control of.
When you talk about situations becoming untenable and people wanting to opt out, the first place my mind went, I guess, was the topic of suicide, where people say, this is too painful, I cannot function. People who perhaps do not have a terminal illness will say, I want to end my life because my suffering is too great for me to bear now.
Clearly, most suicidal people don't have a realistic picture of their expectation of their future. That the cases of people who are at the end of their lives and who are dying, which this law addresses, simply don't want to prolong that dying. I think that's a very, very, very different case from what we usually think of as a suicide. The classic case of suicide is someone who is in a very, very, very bad place, but can almost certainly be brought back to a meaningful life. Many of us get very depressed, and we even say, gee, things are just going to be awful from here on, but we do go on. And sure enough, the sun rises the next day, and a month or a year or maybe several years later, we see that we were in a bad spot, but things got a lot better. And we certainly have a strong bias in terms of getting people through tough times, both at a personal level and at a professional level. That's just a different case. Most people in this country currently die when someone decides enough is enough. No, don't put me on dialysis. No, I'm in congestive heart failure. Don't put me on a heart-lung machine. So I would just distinguish the case where life is clearly winding to an end from people in, quote, midlife, whose troubles, one certainly hopes, are temporary. The critics of the Right to Die movement are funded, by and large, by the Catholic Church, or at least by church organizations who have ideological reasons for opposing us. But that is not going to sell to the public. So the argument that is used and has been used to defeat us in various initiatives is that this is terribly, terribly risky and it will spread. So safeguards are put in place in the Oregon law, and I think you probably mentioned them in other segments, that people must be terminal. They must be within 6 months of death, which is, by the way, a criteria the federal government has set up for hospice care, eligibility for hospice care. The result of this is that some people whom one might feel sympathetic about having access, for instance, the Alzheimer's patient, are out of luck. You can't have it both ways. You can't have elaborate safeguards without impinging on some legitimate cases.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about the proposed Minnesota Compassionate Care Act of 2015, and our guest for this second part of the program is Dr. David Mayo, UMD Professor Emeritus of Philosophy and a board member of the Death with Dignity National Center. I also asked him about Brittany Maynard and about Kirk Allison's contention that sometimes it's not always just about the individual.
Well, I think that train has left the station. People have a right to determine their own health care, whether a woman has a mastectomy or whether someone undergoes chemo or whether someone enters hospice or whether a woman has an abortion does not depend upon how this affects the family, except in as much as that figures in the person's own thinking. Whether someone has or forgoes a medical procedure is up to them. They have the right to decide that. So even if a family member is very upset that Fred is marrying Mabel, that doesn't cut any ice. They still get to do it if that's what they want to do. And if someone wants to have some medical procedure that their doctor thinks is advisable, their friend or family or spouse doesn't get to step in and say, no, that would upset me. that would mess up my life. You don't get to do that.
One of the other points that Kirk made was that the disabled community opposes the Compassionate Care Act with the idea that perhaps disabled lives are going to be seen as less valuable somehow.
I would not deny for a minute that people with disabilities get this message that their lives don't count. If the buses that have lowering ramps don't work, they may not get repaired as fast as they should. So I'm totally sympathetic to the concerns of the disability community. But I don't buy the argument that this law is going to make a significant difference there. I mean, I don't think there's a skyrocketing of disregard for the disabled in Oregon as a result of this. And there certainly haven't been disabled people right and left who are so depressed, that they decide they want to avail themselves of this law.
One of the things that folks usually trot out, as a professor of philosophy, can you talk just a little bit about the validity of the slippery slope argument?
Well, there are different slippery slope arguments. I think some of them are very good. The 14-year-old girl is well advised not to let the guy leave his hand on her thigh for too long, or there's going to be serious trouble. If the dieting person has one potato chip, the chances that that's going to lead to others is pretty high. But the question of whether allowing this will lead to that is an empirical question. And it seems to me the empirical data is there in Oregon. This slope has not proved slippery. Art Kaplan said in an article in the Chicago Tribune a few weeks ago, the fears are real, they're just completely ungrounded. There just has not been a slippery slope phenomenon in Oregon. If you have a malevolent family who wants to do away with an ailing rich relative, this law isn't going to make the difference. They can be manipulated or urged or nudged not to have the expensive surgery. They can be urged not to want to spend their last month in intensive care. They can be urged to enter hospice. There's just no evidence that people have been manipulated into opting to get this medication and then to take it. In fact, most of the people who actually have taken this medication over the years in Oregon are pretty strong-willed, independent people who want to be in control.
This Friday at 6 p.m., UMD's Center for Ethics and Public Policy will hold a panel discussion on the proposed Minnesota Compassionate Care Act of 2015, which would make lethal medication available to terminally ill patients from their doctors in order to end their own lives. In addition to the two guests we featured this evening, Friday's panel discussion includes Minnesota Senator Chris Eaton, the author of the act, and Jonathan Sandy, the director of St. Mary's Medical Center's Ethics Program and Essentia Health East Advanced Care Planning. And in related news, just this afternoon, California Governor Jerry Brown signed into law a measure allowing physicians to prescribe lethal doses of drugs to terminally ill patients who want to hasten their deaths. California becomes the fifth state to allow so-called assisted suicide, following Oregon, Washington, Montana, and Vermont. Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. Thanks to our guests, Kirk Allison, the director of the Program in Human Rights and Health at the University of Minnesota, and Dr. David Mayo, UMD Professor Emeritus of Philosophy and a board member of the Death with Dignity National Center. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.